Hey, this is Eddie Spaghetti from the greatest rock and roll band in the world, the Supersuckers.
Hey, this is Joe from the Mises.
This is Adam Franklin from Slow Driver.
This is Artie Lang from the Howard Stern Show.
Hey, this is John from the Fed.
Hey, this is Rick Kubik, drummer from Natarose.
This is Josh Hayden from Spain.
Matt Sharp from The Rentals, and you are listening to...
And you're listening to the Dark Stuff Podcast.
And you're listening to the Dark Stuff Podcast.
The Dark Stuff Podcast.
Hello, 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 everyone. It's me, Dave Splash, from thedarkstuff.com and the Dark Stuff Podcast, back with another podcast, number 116. And this features part one of my two-part interview with Arenda Fink. Arenda Fink is a great recording artist who currently lives in Omaha. She's originally from Alabama, then she moved to Georgia. Now she's made her way up here to Omaha. She has recorded three solo albums, and she's also been a member of the bands Little Red Rocket, Azure Ray, Art in Manila, and O Plus S. She's also collaborated and is featured on recordings by Now It's Overhead, Bright Eyes, and she's been a touring member of the group Rilo Kiley. Arenda came by the bunker for the interview, and we started off by talking about her newest record, Blue Dream. Now, I've been a fan of her music since I first heard Azure Ray about 10 years ago, and I've always enjoyed it. Azure Ray stuff was great. I liked her first two solo albums. I like the O Plus S. I like Art in Manila. But I have to say, in all honesty, it wasn't until this new album, Blue Dream, that I really, really felt affected by the music. And that's not to say that the other stuff wasn't fantastic, because it was. It was great. But this new album just seemed to really overwhelm me when I listened to it. And when Arenda and I discussed the making of the album and the nature of it and what led to the writing of all the songs, it's a really, really deep story, and I don't even want to get into it myself. I'm going to let the interview speak for itself, but it was a fascinating interview. The new album is really, really great. It's out now, so I recommend going to a record store immediately, picking it up. If you do the download thing, that's your business. Go ahead, download it, I guess. But I have seen the packaging for the vinyl, and it looks pretty impressive. So if you're still a vinyl junkie like I am, spend the extra couple of bucks, kick in a few shekels for the vinyl, because it's a really nice package. The interview was pretty long. We discussed a lot of stuff, so I'm making it into a two-part episode. In part one of the interview, we talk about the new album, Blue Dream, the making of the album, and the inspiration behind the songs. This is a very moody and reflective, and some might say dark album, but there's also one of these things where there's like light at the end of the tunnel. You might want to say that's inspirational, perhaps. I don't want to mislead anybody. It's not some gospel record or anything, but it is a very, very powerful and moving record, and I don't want to delve too much into the story. I just would rather you hear Arenda tell the story. After discussing the new album, we then go into Arenda's past. We start talking about her first band, Little Red Rocket. We get into Azure Ray, and part one ends about the time when Azure Ray went on hiatus about 10 years ago. Part two will be coming next, and in that one we discuss everything that she's done from the ending of Azure Ray to the reunion of Azure Ray, but everything else included up to the current new record, as well as I like to do in every podcast, discuss the state of the music business. So that's something to look forward to. Before we get into the interview, just a quick thing. We are on Facebook, facebook.com/thedarkstuffpodcast. I'd appreciate some likes on that. Please subscribe to the podcast, whether it's at iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, any of the myriad of places we have. Subscribe to it so you never miss an episode. I'm also going to be starting a new e-newsletter. And if you go to www.thedarkstuff.com, there is an entry form so you can give your email. The email is never sold. It's never used for anything. It's strictly for this newsletter. It's been suggested by a couple of people that maybe if we had a little newsletter to keep people up to date on what's going on in the shows, they would never miss it. Of course, also, if you were subscribed, you'd never miss it either. But that's another story. Last things before I let you go is make sure you find me on Twitter, at Dave Splash. Now let's get into the interview. This is my interview with Arenda Fink on the Dark Stuff Podcast. So, okay, we'll start off with the new album. It's called Blue Dream, and it is your third solo album, correct?
Yes, that's
okay. Correct. Third solo album. Now, in the press stuff and things that I've been reading, I've been listening a lot to your music the last like 3 days and doing a little research trying to get ready. A lot of what they're talking about is they're saying the theme of the album is sort of reflections on loss or reflections on death. And another angle to it is about this sort of the dream concept of sort of understanding dreams. Am I on mm-hmm. the right path on this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
So what's the truth about that, or what's the correct way of sort of saying, what were you, I mean, it's not a concept album in the sense of like, you know, Pink Floyd or something like that, right? It's just sort of, I don't want to speak for you, but you know.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's not a concept album, but I think what was happening in my life influenced it so much that, you know, that's why I'm talking about these concepts, because I think it was a direct inspiration for it, even though I wasn't setting out to make a concept record about that per se.
Right.
But yeah, it was, so I started writing it about a year after my dog died. And, for me, that was a huge event in my life, 'cause I had him for 16 years. And,
oh yeah.
You know, I got him when I was 21, and that was, you know, several bands ago, and several states ago, and several boyfriends ago, and he just kind of was this constant in my life, I feel like, when there wasn't any other constant. And so I think, you know, as I was approaching, you know, 37 years old, and faced with the fact, you know, I knew he was very sick for a long time. And, you know, I just didn't want to let him go. And I kept him alive probably, you know, it depends on, you know, who you ask, maybe longer than I should have, because it was just extremely difficult for me to picture him not in my life. So I knew that it was going to be hard going into it, but I had this idea that it would just be, you know, devastating. I'd be upset for a week and, you know, close myself off and, you know, and then finally get over it and kind of come out a new person. You know, I was even kind of giving myself a pep talk in a weird way, just saying, well, you know, I won't have to take care of this sick dog anymore. I could travel,
you know, right.
I could do all this stuff. And So when it finally came down to when I had to put him down, you know, that just wasn't the case at all. You know,
it had a much bigger effect on you than you even imagined.
Yeah, it did. It was, you know, it's, I guess like looking back a little bit, something akin to like an existential crisis. You know, it was, I think that, you know, I had placed a lot, psychologically on him, and so there was that, losing that part, like losing a, like I think I actually lost a part of myself that I didn't know where it went anymore, and on top of that I didn't know where he went,
right.
And I didn't really have like a spiritual framework. I realized I didn't believe in anything. I took no comfort in any kind of, you know, prescribed spiritual dogma or Rainbow Bridge poem or anything like that.
Right.
So I kind of like spiraled down into this deep depression, where it kind of was more than about Wilson, more about the dog and more about my life and my husband's life, my sister's life, my family's life, my friend's life. And like, you know, where do we go when we die? What happens, you know?
So these are like major topics. These are things that people have been discussing and wondering about for thousands of years, essentially. These are like the major questions.
Yeah, and I'd never thought about them in that way before. You know, I mean, everyone thinks about it, but I hadn't become all consumed by it before. And that's what happened, and I kind of, you know, went into a pretty long depressive episode because I didn't feel anything. You know, I didn't feel that there was no answer that seemed to be comforting or correct to me, and I felt very lost.
So that was the impetus for then writing these songs.
Well, I didn't get there yet. I actually I went on antidepressants And that kind of, you know, put a Band-Aid over it for a while. And then that it actually ended up not working anymore. And so I started seeing a psychotherapist who a friend recommended to me for grief therapy. And she also happened to be a Jungian dream analyst, which I didn't know that when I booked the appointment with her. But so what happened was I called her, and I'd never been to a therapist before, surprisingly, after listening to my music. You might think that's funny.
Well, no, it's more common than you would imagine, but at the same time, there are sometimes people just assume, oh, everyone's done it. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you realize, no, not everyone hasn't done it, actually.
Yeah, yeah, I somehow had never done it. So I didn't know what to expect, but I knew that what I was doing was not working. So I booked this appointment with this woman here in town, and she, like I said, she also specialized in Jungian dream analysis. And
that's Carl Jung, for
yes,
those listeners that don't know who that was.
And so literally, you know, the day after I booked the appointment, and the week that led up to it, I started having dreams that were of a very big, vibrant, heavy nature. And they were centered around Wilson, mostly. And this was something new since he had died. And so when I went into my first appointment...
Now, had you been able to remember dreams in the past? I mean, is it something that you... Because a lot of people just don't remember the second you wake up. Was this something that you have actually, throughout your life, you've been able to remember them?
Yeah, I have had a pretty intense dream life throughout my life. My dream experience is pretty, it's pretty commanding. So I have been familiar with that, like, you know, having these powerful dreams, having these images, you know, I use them sometimes in my music and kind of to inform, you know, certain images, but I hadn't thought about them. I hadn't thought about where they come from, you know, and what they mean, really what they mean. You know, I always just kind of thought of them as like fragmentary and intense, you know, but it wasn't until I started going to her and, you know, after we talked for a little while in the first appointment, you know, she asked me if I had had any dreams, and I told her, you know, about the dreams I'd had that week. And so we started immediately going into dream analyzation, and that was when the dam broke.
Interesting.
And that began a year-long dream craziness, you know, with the therapy and the dreams that went on for a year.
So when you say the craziness, you mean in just your studying of your dreams and figuring out what they mean, or did your dreams take on a new sort of, a new angle once you started becoming informed by this new information that you're getting?
They went to a new angle. I mean, there was many like phases of dreams at that point, you know, and they started out with me with Wilson in my dreams alive, and he was always in some kind of mortal danger, and I would always save him at the end from this danger. And then I would wake up, or, you know, before I would wake up, I was so happy that he was still alive, and, you know, I could feel him, I could smell him, he's like licking my face, I'm holding him. And then I'd wake up and realize that he was dead still, and I'd be very sad. And so I had several of those dreams, and, you know, I went to my therapist and told her, you know, these are the nature of the dreams I'm having. You know, I feel like it's clear that they're saying that, you know, I wished I could have saved him, or I was trying to save him, you know. And she was like, I don't think it's Wilson that you're trying to save in these dreams. And that was kind of the very first tip of the iceberg, where I understood that if you dive deeper into the symbolism of the dreams, it's more than you think it is.
Yeah.
You know, and so after that, you know, they kind of progressed into more of what I consider like a part of the grief process of a healing is that I had to keep putting him to sleep over and over again in my dreams. And I kept having to make the decision to do it and doing it until at some point I literally became okay with it. Like, I had enough dreams that I gave myself or whoever
Right.
You know, the healing that I was like, okay, I finally forgive myself for this. I finally understand that this needed to happen and, you know, that I can move on from that. And then it was kind of like, once I moved on from that, they started taking a more esoteric nature and actually dealing with the concepts, I believe, of nature and life and death and the circle of life and, you know, basically eternal consciousness and the collective unconscious. And so that it definitely came in phases like that. It was almost like, whether you consider it the psyche or, you know, something more spiritual, like it was, they were phases of healing and then into a more spiritual nature. And this was all over the span of, you know, about a year.
And then how did that manifest itself into actually writing songs? Were you taking ideas from specific dreams that you had, or was it more informed by what you had learned through this time in this therapy? Or, I mean, I don't know. What was the next step, I guess? When did it become, okay, these are, you know, I've made this breakthrough. Okay. I'm now understanding what the problem is necessarily. I've come to this new realization. Now is it, I'm artistically inspired, you know, get me a guitar and a notebook and let's go? Or how, I mean, what was the next sort of phase?
Yeah, you know, it's honestly, it's like hard for me to even kind of place it all, because it was such a crazy, you know, time period for me, and I was so in my head, literally. But I wrote most of it after all of it was over. You know, at one point the dreams just stopped. I asked for them to stop because it was getting a little too heavy for me. And they stopped, and most of it I wrote after that, not realizing I was writing a record. I just was able to write again. Because I didn't write at all during this period.
So would you say you had a block, or you just didn't, I mean, would you try to do something creative? I mean, everyone has their own process, so mm-hmm. sometimes it's just, you know, some people are like, I get up in the morning and I start writing, and that's just like my job, or others can't do it unless something just kind of pops in their head. Were you struggling with trying to write something, or was it just, you just weren't interested at that time?
I just wasn't interested. I was truly a broken person. I was so broken that I couldn't even begin to take where I was and filter that into anything acceptable or meaningful to anyone. You know, I just didn't even try. And so I just waited till I felt that I could communicate something. So that was pretty far down the line. So I ended up not writing at all for a year.
And then it just kind of poured out of you once you started, or was it kind of a slower process?
I'd say probably 6 or 8 months the whole record was done. But like I said, I wasn't writing a record. I was just writing. And at some point I kind of looked back and I was like, oh, I have these songs, you know, I have these 10 or 12 songs, and they're, I think this is a record. Like, I think this is a cohesive, and maybe more cohesive in a way than my other solo records, like, because it was all coming from one well, it felt like, right. One spring, you know. And so I looked back and I kind of listened to him, and I was like, I think this is a record.
Thank you. started seeing this therapist and understanding about, you know, dream analysis and this kind of thing, did you then take it a step further? Did you actually study the science behind it? I mean, Jerry, is that something that you're interested in? And being able to, if somebody said, oh my God, Arenda, you know, I had this dream the other night and it was this and that. Are you interested in trying to help people figure out what that is? Or is that just, you know what, no, that leave that to the professionals or something? I mean...
Yeah, no, I love analyzing dreams. Okay. I love it, but I'm certainly not a professional at it. I mean, so, you know, I think between all my sessions with my therapist and where we mostly talked about dreams, interestingly enough, I mean, the dreams were the therapy. There has not been a single session I've ever went to where there wasn't at least one dream analyzed, if not several. Right. You know, and it was like the dream started the therapy, and then the therapy came from the dream. So the dream told me what I needed to talk about with her. So that's, I've just come armed with my dreams, and that would be the session. And, you know, things that would bring me to my knees, you know, weeping, like it was definitely exactly what I needed to get through was what my dreams were telling me to talk about. So I think between those therapy sessions, and then, you know, the small amount that I have read about Jung and dream analysis, I can do a pretty good armchair analysis, but it is very amateur. But I do love doing it. And yeah, my sister said it's funny because she's like, most people hate hearing other people's dreams. And
I don't want to hear what you dreamed about unless you dreamed about me or whatever. That's that, like, built a spill line or something. Like, nobody cares what you're dreaming about unless you're dreaming about them, right? I mean, that was the sort of the joke or whatever, but...
Right, but I think, you know, that's the thing, the cool thing about dreams is if you tune your mind into it and you know a little bit about how they work, you could tell if someone was dreaming about you, even if you're not in the dream.
They're not even aware of it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly, and that's what's fascinating about it. Like, sometimes someone can tell you a dream and you're like, oh, or for me, I'll be like, oh, okay, this is what's going on with you. Gotcha. They don't even know it.
So, the making of the record... you made it here in Omaha, and Bill Rieflin, I believe is his last
name.
Rieflin, okay. From Ministry, formerly, he used to play with REM, I know that for a long time. He was involved in this record. Your husband, Todd, is one of the producers of the record, and I don't have it in front of me, so I don't remember the other folks, but how did you first get involved with Bill? Because he's been around for a very long time, and I didn't know he had any connection to Omaha, really. I assumed he was either Chicago or the Northwest or something.
Right, he is. Oh, real quick, Ben Brodeen is the producer.
Ben Brodeen,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and then Todd co-produced, and then Bill played drums.
Okay.
Bill, I met Bill many years ago when the band I was playing bass in, Now It's Overhead, opened for REM on a European tour.
Oh, wow.
When he was playing drums, and that was right when I'd first released Invisible Ones, my first solo record.
Okay.
So I'd given Bill a copy of my record on that tour, and apparently he just had listened to that record up until now. It was one of his favorite records, and I had no idea. And I ran into him a couple weeks before I started recording Blue Dream. Originally, Ben Brodeen, the guy that produced it, he also plays drums. He was going to play the drums. But I ran into Bill at a bar in Athens, Georgia, and we were catching up, and he asked me, you know, if I was doing any music, and I said, actually, I'm going to record a solo record in a couple weeks. And he just said, I'm coming to play drums on it. And I was like, oh, you've had a couple of drinks.
Yeah.
I was like, and he said, I'm serious. And I was like, okay, I'll text you tomorrow and say hi and, you know, see what you say. So I texted him tomorrow or the next day, and he was like, yeah, I'm totally serious. And he just, you know, it was interesting because, you know, he kind of, so I bought the ticket for him, and, you know, a couple weeks later, there's Bill Rieflin in my living room. And he told me and Todd that he just had a kind of an epiphany in his life that, you know, life is short, and he really wanted to trust the universe as it put things in his path. And since he had listened to that record so intensely all these years and ran into me a couple weeks before I was recording another one, he just knew it was meant to be done. Yeah, he had to be a part of the new record, and that's why he did it. And I thought that was really... kind of cool in light of kind of the cosmic nature of the whole record too. So So anyway, he came and stayed for 5 days, and we just had a marvelous time with him. He's an amazing human being outside of a drummer.
He's played with a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, over the years, you look at his resume, or, you know, lack of a better word, but who he's played with, just a million different projects. All of them so different from REM, which is where he wound up, you know, as the touring drummer for REM, which I was always fascinated by. Like, you see, like, Revolting Cocks and all these different groups, and then it's like, oh yeah, REM.
Yeah, you know he's playing for King Crimson right now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. So he's not going to be out on tour with you when you go out?
No, I'm going to do, since this is the first time I've gone out in years as a solo artist, I'm just going to do a very stripped down crew for the first one. So I'm doing samples.
Okay.
And yeah, it's just a three piece. So yeah, unfortunately, if I keep touring on the record, I'd love to, you know, go out with them, but we'll see how that goes.
Now, how is, who else plays on the record besides yourself, Bill? Who else plays with you?
Ben Brodine and Todd. So, you know, basically that core group, the three of them played most everything. I played very little, actually.
Okay.
and then I had some great singers that sang on it. Pearl Boyd from Ally Con Bandana, my sister Christine Fink, and Susan Sanchez, and then my neighbor Greg Elsasser played saw. Pat Oakes from Ladyfinger played percussion. I think that's everybody.
Now, this is the album. You said it was co-produced by your husband, Todd from The Faint, for those that don't know. Is this the first time that you've worked together in this kind of capacity? And is it something that you'd want to do again?
It's not really the first time, because he produced the Haruki Zombie stuff. I don't know if you're familiar with that side project.
I don't know. I'm not sure about that one.
It's kind of a dance music art project that I have with Nina Barnes, the wife of Kevin Barnes from Love Montreal.
Okay.
So more it's electronic music, so he produced that. For us, and that was kind of just, we did it at home type of thing. But I kind of knew that was like the turning point where we can definitely work together.
Okay.
You know? And so he's helped me with a couple of things since then. And then, I don't know. I really enjoy working with him. I trust him a lot. And, you know, we live together, which makes it very easy.
Right.
So I'm definitely looking forward to, you know, always working with him in the future.
Now, what's the touring situation? When do you go? When do you leave?
I go on September 18th.
September 18th. Okay. And I know you're back in Omaha in November.
November 1st.
November 1st for a show then. Okay. Now, I want to discuss your past, but this, since you mentioned the touring situation, you haven't been out in a while, I wanted to kind of address that. Now, for touring today, I mean, when was the last time you've actually been out on a tour? And I don't mean just yourself, but with whatever group, with Azure Ray, with whatever. When was the last time you've been out on a, what you'd consider a real tour?
I guess that we did a tour for the EP that we put out, As Above, So Below, but I don't remember when that was.
I mean, I'm just wondering,
how
do you feel the tour? I mean, the touring landscape is so different now, it seems, than maybe when you began your career, even at the beginning of the decade or whatever, or the century, in 2000, 2001. How has it changed for you? I mean, is it still something that you actually, I mean, are you excited about going out for 6 weeks and being gone and living in a van or on the bus or whatever and going through that whole rigmarole these days? Is that something you're now looking forward to?
I am looking forward to this especially because I haven't toured solo in so long. In fact, I think I just did one solo tour for Invisible Ones and that's it. I didn't even tour on Ask the Night. So I feel like I have a renewed sense to, to get on the road, even if it's not great, you know,
right.
Attendance-wise, I'm just feeling inspired to perform this record. And so I guess that kind of trumps all that other stuff. Like, I already am going into it just knowing that I'm excited just to perform the music. So the rest of it is just icing on the cake or not,
right.
You know.
Is a part of something greater. A star will start.
Talk a little bit about your history. I mean, how long have you considered yourself a musician or an artist? When did you first sort of make that realization about yourself?
Well, I started writing songs with Maria from Azure when we were in high school. So, you know, I guess I would have been 17 when we started writing our first songs. I didn't, you know, really understand what it would mean to have a career in music at that point. Young age, but right. I knew that that's all I wanted to do at that point. So, you know.
So there was no plan B after that?
No, not really. I mean, I've gone to school a couple of times, you know, just to like, if I'm fed up with everything or, you know, in the beginning, Marie and I both, you know, before we really took our career seriously, we did a few semesters at college, but then we got signed to Geffen. and with Little Red Rocket, and that kind of was like the no turning back point, you know. And so, yeah, I don't know. I have, you know, like I said, I've toyed with the thought of having other careers in the past, but at some point I just knew, like, I'm a lifer. Like, there's no way.
Now, was there how many instruments do you play? What instruments do you play?
I play several instruments mediocrely.
Okay.
But
enough that you can write great songs, so you obviously have enough of an understanding of the instrument. I guess you play the instruments enough to understand that you know how to work these songs. I mean, I've seen people who are genius on their instrument. They can't create shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just know how to technically do it, but they don't have the creative right. capacity for it.
Yeah.
You know? So, I guess, okay, I don't know, that wasn't really a question, I suppose. So, was there a record or a song in your life, or maybe an experience seeing someone in concert or something, where you decided, or you thought to yourself, wow, I want to do that. Like, that. This is something that I know I think I could do, or I want to try that out. I mean, you don't just come upon writing songs with somebody unless you had thought about it at least once or twice prior, I would imagine, right?
I'm trying to think back. I mean, I feel like, you know, to bring up REM, like, you know, probably the year before I met Maria in high school, was the time that Out of Time came out.
Okay.
And I remember that record, I remember listening to that record and thinking, you know, as a kid, basically, I was like, it was the first pop record that I felt had real depth to it. You know, I was like, wow, this
yeah.
is music to me. This like resonates with me in a really special way. And I think for some reason that record, you know, but that was even before I started playing guitar, but that record is, I think, planted the seed that popular music could be something that came from your heart, something that could be dark.
Right.
You know?
Doesn't have to be this manufactured bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know that everyone's got that record for themselves, but that was the record for me for some reason. I grew up in the rural South, so it wasn't like I was exposed to a lot of different things.
Right.
But that was the record for me. So, you know, when I met Maria, I had just been learning to play the acoustic guitar because I was bored. And I did find it to be a cathartic activity, but I hadn't written any songs. And she was the songwriter. She came from a family, you know, her father's a songwriter and a musician. So she was the one that actually said, she saw that I play guitar, and she didn't play guitar. And she was like, let's start a band together and write songs. And so she kind of taught me how to write a song. But, you know, I caught on pretty quickly, and we started writing together, singing together. And then she learned to play the guitar, and that's how we kind of ended up being this duo.
Now, where did you grow up? You said the rural South. Where are you from originally?
Alabama. We moved around a lot, though. So, you know, I lived in Tuscaloosa for a little while, Alabaster. But Asheville, Alabama was where I spent a lot of my youth. And then I ended up going to the Alabama School of Fine Arts in Birmingham for my last 2 years of high school. And that's when I met Maria.
That's when you met Maria. Yeah. Okay. How did you think that growing up in the South has affected your music, your artistic sensibilities? I mean, I assume it has had an effect. How do you think it's affected you?
Yeah, I think it's definitely had an effect. I mean, I think it's had a huge effect on who I am personally. Therefore, you know, I think my music, but I mean, I think that there's definitely a romanticism about the South. I feel like that there's a lot of poetry in the South and a lot of tragedy.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm definitely inspired by kind of those elements of the Southern Gothic genre. Specifically of literature. I feel
right.
like those kind of...
William Faulkner and stuff like that.
Yeah, Flannery O'Connor. That sensibility filters into my work quite a bit. And outside of that, you know, I think just... The Southerners just have, like, a very, you know, unique way of kind of thinking about themselves and, you know, I guess... what you're doing in life, you know? It's like, I don't know, I guess I just don't take myself too seriously.
Right.
Maybe that's to a fault sometimes.
Okay, so you met Maria in high school, and that was your first band, but you were the group Little Red Rocket, that was the group, right?
Yes.
And that was the one that you said was signed to Geffen?
Correct.
When you were just out of high school?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, how did Geffen Records... come across a tape by two high school girls who were playing songs in Alabama?
Oh, at that point, we actually had a band together,
okay.
A rock band, and that was Little Red Rocket. And we played, I don't know if they still have it, but it was a small music festival then called the NEA, the Nashville... I can't remember it. I think the Nashville... Entertainment Association?
Something? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Could
Anyways,
be.
it was kind of like a you know mini South by Southwest
okay.
in Nashville, and I think there was a guy in Birmingham that was helping us out at that point because you know we were a young up and coming band in Birmingham, and so he got us this random show at the showcase, and there happened to be an A&R person from Geffen, and it was just like the dream story. You know,
right.
He walks up to us after the show and says, "I'm from Geffen Records. I want to sign you." Tomorrow, you know, where can I fax a contract?
Wow.
And we literally, I think, signed it the next day.
Now, obviously, the group ended at some point before your modern career. So, what happened with the band? I mean, I'm familiar with your career once As Your Race starts. Only in doing research did I find out about Little Red Rocket. Can people still find those records, or what happened with that band?
Yeah, the records are out of print, but you can find them. I mean, I think you can find them on eBay and stuff, like maybe even Amazon, I'm not sure. We were dropped from Geffen, and we took the buyout money and made our own record, and that record was the second record, and that was put out by an independent in Boston. And we toured around for a little bit, and then, you know, it's kind of a personal story, but tragedy struck the band, and it kind of changed the environment of, or the landscape of how we felt music should be, or what we were capable of doing. Like, we really couldn't be a party band anymore. We were a party band.
So that's sort of what you were doing. I mean, was it, it was more upbeat, not...
Yeah, it was,
right.
it was rock, it was, like, fun, light, pop, rock
okay.
music. And so, like I said, I think, you know, we had, I don't know, like a change in our hearts and in our consciousness and maybe a coming of age kind of situation too. And we knew that we couldn't continue that band anymore. So we ended it, you know, went out on a high note, just like we all love each other, but it's time for this
right.
band to end. And that's, and then Azure picked up from there. And you can tell by the nature of the music, how different the mindset was between Little Red Rocket and Azure in a span of 1 year.
Now, was it just you and Maria from that band? I mean, nobody else stayed with you. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
So,
okay.
You know, it was me and Maria to begin with, you know, in high school. And then we had, you know, two other members for Little Red Rocket. And then once Little Red Rocket disbanded, Maria and I went back to just me and Maria.
And Azure Ray was based in Georgia, right?
Yes.
Or in Athens.
In Athens.
Okay. Now, how did you How did you first get introduced to the whole world of the Omaha music scene and to Saddle Creek Records? And how did a band from Athens, Georgia, formerly a band from Alabama, wind up in ensconced in the music scene, which in the Omaha music scene, I mean, which was about to have this major explosion is not really the best term, but it was really at a great time for Omaha, for all of those bands. It was definitely like the peak period for a lot of those artists from that time. How did you initially get involved? How did you guys get affiliated with it?
It was through Andy LaMaster. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He is the mastermind behind Nauts Overhead.
Okay.
And he is also an amazing producer and engineer and had been working with Connor since, you know, the very early days. I can't remember how Andy met Connor, but somehow Andy had already been working with Connor, and the Bright Eyes came through town, and, you know, we were good friends with Andy, and Andy was good friends with, you know, the Omaha crew, so we all ended up hanging out together, and I think our record just got passed on to Connor and Saddle Creek, and Bright Eyes, he asked us if we wanted to open for Bright Eyes. So that was our first time ever coming to Omaha. Was to fly in and rehearse for that tour. And I remember.
And what year are we talking about here? 2001, 2002?
Probably 2001, I think. And so I think that was just the beginning of it, you know. So we went on tour together, and Saddle Creek wanted to put out our records, and Maria started dating Connor.
Okay, so there you go.
There's one tie-in. And then, you know, about 6 or 7 months later, maybe a year, I started dating Todd. Okay. And before you know it, we had lots of ties to Omaha.
Okay, so, and that's, when did you actually relocate here?
Let's see. I don't know. I'm terrible with years. So maybe 2003 or 4?
Okay. Now, how do you think Omaha has affected your... I mean, in the same way that you're growing up in the South is one thing. Okay, now you're in a completely different place, Omaha. How do you think that relocating to the Midwest or to Omaha has affected your music or your art in any way?
I can't say, like, aesthetically how it's affected it. Maybe I just haven't had enough space to see that, you know, at this point.
Right.
But I know it's definitely affected it in that there are so many amazing people to collaborate with here and to work with and be inspired by. And that wouldn't just happen anywhere. So it's definitely, I'm not in a bubble here.
Right.
So I'm getting, you know, it's affected by Ben Brodeen's style of guitar playing on Blue Dream. You know, it's affected by, you know, Pearl and Christine's singing, like, or, you know, whoever's, like, I'm working with, you know, they are informing the style in a certain way or inspiring. So I think that's a huge part. I think that Omaha is a really, like, forgiving space for an artist, you know. It gives me a lot of space to kind of just figure out what, you know, what it is that I want to express, and then everyone's there to support, you know, how to do that.
Now, have you, in terms of Omaha, like, before you actually came here, what, did you have any impression at all or any idea of what it was like here?
All I knew is it was very cold and snowy and gray. Because I'd only been here in the wintertime.
Because I just remember going to college for the first time, and all of these people, when they find out I was from Omaha, would ask the dumbest questions, like, do I live on a farm?
Uh-huh.
Do I have running water? You know, stuff like that. And it was just like, wow, that's the impression that people have. Like, I didn't realize
that.
Yeah,
I know. It's so funny. Like, when I left Athens to come here, I mean, people were saying that kind of stuff. I'm like, wow, you know Omaha's got it bad when people in Georgia think it's the boonies, but, yeah.
So, okay, so Azure Ray was your band for a while, and then about 2004, you guys decided to break up?
Sounds about right.
Okay, I'm guessing only because I know that the Invisible Ones record was dated 2005, so
okay.
I'm assuming
yeah.
2004. Now, what was behind the breakup? Why did you guys decide to call it quits at that time?
I mean, well, we always called it an indefinite hiatus, you know, even at that time. But I think we had just been just going at it for so long together, you know, living together, writing songs together, touring together, that we wanted to kind of forge our own, or have the opportunity to, like, forge our own creative identities. And I feel like, you know, we both kind of had those leanings, those gnawings in there. And so, you know, ultimately we decided the best way to do that would be to just take a break. And we were tired, you know. Ezra toured so much during those years that I think we just needed to, you know, like I said, take a hiatus.
Okay, so I hope you really enjoyed that. This will end part one of my interview with Arenda Fink. The next podcast, number 117. Will be featuring part two of the interview. Before we get there, though, let's close out with a little bit of music from Azure Ray, since that's what we were just discussing. And until next time, friends, thanks a lot for listening. This has been the Dark Stuff Podcast.
Transfer of data is complete.